The truth of the matter? Life goes on, though it should not. The poet sings, understood not. I can die, but I would not.
Throughout his life, Arkansas poet and critic John Gould Fletcher fitfully retained the hope that a truth-telling, creative personality would not merely conjure a perfect world inside the transparent eye of a poem, but redeem a modern society bereft of identity and mission.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Ben Johnson. His biography, Fierce Solitude, published by the University of Arkansas Press, remembers the tumultuous life of Arkansas poet John Gould Fletcher.
In 1938, he garnered the Pulitzer Prize for Poetry, and in 1949, he was installed in the American Institute of Arts and Letters.
Biographer Ben Johnson talks about Arkansas Pulitzer Prize-winning poet John Gould Fletcher on Arts and Letters.
Cherokee dreams. Leering, sneering, scowling, threatening faces. Weeping, twisting, yelling, howling faces. Faces fixed in contortion between a scream and a laugh, meaningless faces. I will cover the walls of night with faces till you do not know if these faces are but masks, or you the masks for them. Faces too grotesque for laughter. Faces too shattered by pain for tears. Faces of such ugliness that the ugliness grows beauty. They will haunt you morning, evening, burning, burning, ever returning, their own infamy creating, till you strike at life and hate it, burn your soul up, so in hating.
I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with biographer Ben Johnson about the life and times of Arkansas poet John Gould Fletcher.
He was one type of poet early in his career. He had a middle career when he began writing a much different type of verse. And then toward the end of his career, both in terms of his topic and his approach and the structure, his poetry was different. So that inconstancy made him hard to peg. It made him hard to put in any one school. It made him hard to associate him with any one type of trend in modern literature.
A fervent agrarian in paradox, a man filled with contradictions that have baffled scholars and deepened his obscurity. Ben Johnson, professor, historian, biographer, welcome.
Thank you so much, Brad. I appreciate you inviting me.
So before his suicide in 1950, John Gould Fletcher's books were virtually out of print, and he was disappearing from anthologies. What intrigued you about him?
Well, the truth, Brad, is that Fletcher represented for me an opportunity. I was working on my dissertation at the University of Arkansas and really needed a topic, and quickly decided that the Fletcher biography was exactly what I needed. I was aware, though just barely, of John Gould Fletcher. Here was the thing. His papers, including his correspondence, his manuscripts, and his journals, were housed at the special collections at the University of Arkansas in Fayetteville. And a number of scholars, particularly those in Southern studies, believed and had written that Fletcher was long overdue for a biography.
John Gould Fletcher's story, his memories, his dream life began in the old house.
In 1889, when John Gould Fletcher was 3 years old, his family moved into a Little Rock, Arkansas mansion with a history colored by legend.
All over the house there is a sense of futility, of minutes dragging by slowly and repeating some worn-out story of broken effort and desire.
So would you tell us about the legend of the Pike House?
Well, it had apparently a ghost. Albert Pike had built the house, but he built it on the eve of the Civil War. And Albert Pike went off to war and really never came back to the house. He had separated from his wife, who in the memoirs and memories of Little Rock residents at the time was a sort of hidden, reclusive figure. And John Gould Fletcher and others often saw her as an ever-present ghost in the house.
And it is because we keep fear down under what we are pleased to call our real selves that it grows to a horrible monster in the dark cloisters of that subconscious of which we have lurid glimpses in many troubled dreams.
It was the largest house in Little Rock. It had very expansive grounds, and for a young, isolated child full of imagination, he could conjure up all sorts of images, even if there was not a ghost.
The Black Stairs. In the afternoon, when no one is in the house, I suddenly hear dull, dragging feet go fumbling down those dark back stairs that climb up twisting as if they wanted no one to see them. Beating a dirge upon the bare planks, I hear those feet and the creak of a long-locked door. My mother often went up and down those self-same stairs, from the room where by the window she would sit all day and listlessly look on the world that had destroyed her. She would go down in the evening to the room where she would sleep, or rather not sleep, but all night lie staring fiercely at the ceiling. In the afternoon, when no one is in the house, I suddenly hear dull, dragging feet beating out their futile tune up and down those dark back stairs, but there is no one in the shadows.
Adolphine Krauss Fletcher, his mother, nurtured her children in splendid isolation. What was his relationship to his mother?
Just one more question, then I'll let you go. Did I treat you right, or was I cold? Well, I tried my best, but I'm a woman with a lot of unrest, and there's more a-coming.
Fletcher's relationship to his mother was certainly one that was complicated. It was marked by resentment and affection and a sense of betrayal.
Never did I try to give you my all. I learned to let it slide till it hit the wall. But now this buries me, these skies are barbed wire. I'm 6 feet deep and I'm still on fire. I'm still on fire.
His lifelong devotion to music and his immersion in literature began with his mother, and yet she also proved to be the first to find his talents wanting, and she expressed her clear disapproval when he failed to learn to play a musical instrument, even in a rudimentary way.
From Portofino Point, music of violins and guitars rises up straight from the night, slow like great walls of deep flame. Music of faint winds that whisper, rattling like thin drifts of hail through the pale olive trees. Music of mountains that sweep purple-brown waves frozen high over the horizon edge. Music of blue gulf that summons with slow placid waters soft creeping man's ever-passionate soul.
Just yesterday, I thought I knew it all, but I'm afraid I was so clearly wrong. You see, I held so dear to all my fears. Never let the wind blow through the burning in my soul. Never let you see my tears, my tears.
Ooh. She kept them pretty isolated too, didn't she?
She certainly did. She was overly protective. She apparently feared kidnappers were lurking outside the grounds, but this meant that her son had very little contact with the outside world. And again, that house and the grounds were so large and expansive, it was possible to keep him in that own little green continent. Those who passed the grounds saw the thin, quiet child either walking the grounds beside a tutor or looking from behind the fence with a flat, open gaze. Before he was bundled off to school at the age of 10 in 1896, young Fletcher never strayed unaccompanied beyond the bounds of the estate.
Oh, how would you like to be me and write such fine poetry? Rah, 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 bottle of rum. I feel very, very bum.
We're listening to biographer Ben Johnson talk about his book, Fierce Solitude, and the life of Arkansas poet John Gould Fletcher.
The 6-foot-tall, solid figure with a full white beard, returned home each noon, placed his hat on the hat rack, took his chair just as his meal was placed on the table.
What about his father? Quite a presence.
In contrast to the perceptions of his sisters, who tended to worship the father, John Gough Fletcher recalled his father as remote and conventional. Now, the father's ambitions for his son to be a lawyer and a businessman inspired, again, a sense of resentment and guilt in the son. In other words, his father wished for him to be a man of the world, and John Gough Fletcher shrunk from that responsibility and did feel guilty about it.
A boy crying because his sister is ill in another room and he has no one to play with. A boy listlessly scattering building blocks and crying because no one will build for him the palace of Fata Morgana.
Tell us about his relationship with his sisters.
As a child, as a young boy, Fletcher was particularly close to his younger sister, Mary, who in truth was his only playmate. But as an adult, he was drawn closer to his older sister, Adolphine. She was very much interested in his work, but she was also the one who managed his share of the parents' estate. She was responsible for his income throughout the rest of his life.
Tell us about his early school days.
He had tutors early in his childhood. He was dispatched to a private academy there in Little Rock. He attended the academy, but he was not a particularly strong student. Mathematical calculations bewildered him, and public speaking showed him to be extremely talkative, perhaps overly so, and grammar bored him. Really, only literature could excite him.
I mean, he was somewhat privileged, right?
Very privileged.
Right, and he was going to academies, and he even applied to Harvard. Didn't get in the first time. Was that disappointing to his father?
It was certainly disappointing to his father. His father expected John Gough Fletcher, and I believe he was still only 16 or 17, to be able to be admitted to Harvard. When that failed to happen, his father instead put him in Phillips Academy in Andover, where Fletcher once again was left behind. His father took him to Cambridge, left him at Phillips Academy, took the train back to Little Rock, and there Fletcher was, again, the young boy who really had very few social skills, who had very little interaction with people outside his family, was now basically on his own in a very unfamiliar environment.
From Journey Day. We sought long for salvation, but what we found was not the thing we sought. Now we alone can attain it if we thread through the obscure wood.
We're listening to biographer Ben Johnson talk about his book, Fierce Solitude, and the life of Arkansas poet John Gould Fletcher. This is Arts and Letters. Let's return to our conversation with Ben Johnson as he talks about the early life of Arkansas poet and Pulitzer Prize winner John Gould Fletcher.
You write, at school, Fletcher's tormentors tried to wound him by insisting that his Arkansas family went barefoot, he ate possum, and hoed cotton.
Yes, all of the stereotypes, which likely surprised Fletcher. Again, Fletcher had lived apart from Little Rock, apart from Arkansas. His father's relatives had plantations. They were, if you will, of the Old South. But again, this was as exotic to Fletcher as perhaps it was to his classmates in Massachusetts. Fletcher was surprised by this behavior, and they thought his odd behavior came from his Arkansas upbringing. But Fletcher was a person who had been so isolated from society and from friends, he would struggle in relationships throughout his life.
The hour of peace. It is the hour of silence. No one cares to think of toil now, asking, what is done by all our effort endlessly on streaming? For we are sick of mocking sly despairs, and we would rest as if all time were gone, filling the hour of peace with foolish dreaming.
And so you call the book Fierce Solitude, and was some of the behavior because he isolated himself from people?
He grew up with a very distinct sense of his own individuality. And because of his childhood, because of his upbringing, he had to rely on his imagination. And his imagination assumed its own very clear-cut reality for him. And the nature of his illness also was, if you will, a wall or barrier between him and other people.
My business in life is to be once all men and one man, to produce a great work without working, to lead a romantically impractical life and yet be happy.
So in 1903, in the fall, he was finally admitted to Harvard.
And Fletcher at Harvard did begin to somehow feel that he was arriving in a place in a society where he could find, if you will, fellow travelers. In other words, Harvard at this time was beginning to be affected by the changes of the modern world of the early 20th century. And there were new ways of thinking, and there certainly was a new commitment to literature. Harvard was a place, and there were people there who talked about books, who talked about ideas. And Fletcher was able to finally begin to connect with at least a few people at Harvard.
Clown song. Who can speak the crimes of rhyming, said a poet. Well, he knew what this vile and senseless chiming tempts a singer's soul to do.
At Harvard, he met the free-thinking son of a Long Island physician, Lyman Willits Rogers. With his magnificent shock of yellow hair and slender hands and his nervous, tapering fingers. What was his relationship with Rogers?
Fletcher and Rogers were roommates at Harvard. They were thrown in together. And Lyman Rogers and John Gough Fletcher, they hit it off.
You're my whole wide world.
In other words, this is one of the first real friendships that Fletcher had outside of his family, as far as we understand it.
You're my whole wide world, and the thought of ever losing you. You're my whole wide world. It's 4 a.m.
Certainly a friendship that he talked about, in the sense that they would stay up late at night talking about ideas and philosophy. And Fletcher finally found himself with a person who could engage at this level with these ideas, and he found it thrilling. And Fletcher, in many ways, deferred to Rogers as perhaps the more brilliant, the more charismatic figure. I think he was astounded by him, he was moved by him, but Fletcher finally felt, at least with Rogers, he was finding a person of like-mindedness.
If you should call my name
for nerve enough to tell the dean before I leave, and courage enough to commit suicide quietly afterwards.
So approaching the end of 1904 and 1905, and that academic year, he was convinced that he was about to be expelled. Were his grades that bad, or was it more his behavior?
His grades were not strong. Fletcher did not always attend class. He found himself unable to concentrate on subjects that bored him. Likely, there were stirrings of the depression that would haunt him throughout his life. And this really did not give him the ability, if you will, to continue consistently with the regimen of scholarship. He would avoid class. He would just simply not do the work. And he did face expulsion.
The clouds, blown together like ragged whirls of smoke, stretch long and twisted fingers up in the west, and in their grip hangs weltering, half extinguished, the ruby of the sun.
Give me the chronology here. When does he go to California?
He goes to California during a break. He was to attend, he was accompanying his sister on a trip to a wedding of a friend of hers, and it was on this train trip that he was able to see for the first time the dramatic and expansive landscape of the West.
The sky immense, bejeweled with rain of stars, hangs over us. The stars, like a sudden explosion, powder the zenith with green and gold. Northeast, southwest, the Milky Way's pale streamers flash past in flame, the sky a swirling cataract of fire on high.
What was his relationship to poetry up to this point, or just writing in general? Is this kind of a moment where he starts to see himself as a writer?
It is, and it seems to be the landscape that moves him. It is a landscape that is open and dramatic, and it does, really for the first time, direct him toward the writing of poetry.
We're out west, my son. May he find your day. Nights are restless lights, so the writers say. Roam the desert skies, walk in neon signs. The stars will shine so hard, you can't sleep at night.
Before then, he certainly liked reading literature, he certainly enjoyed reading poetry, but it was hard to predict that his reaction to this Western trip would channel him into the life of a poet. He himself designated this trip as that, if you will, fork in the road. That at that point, he began to think of himself, see himself as a poet, and began to write poetry.
Through the endless night, songs will fade away. On the hillside, in the distance, you might find your way to roam the desert sky and walk the neon signs. The stars will shine so hard. Stars will shine so hard. I hope you sleep tonight.
We're listening to biographer Ben Johnson talk about his book, Fierce Solitude, and the life of Arkansas poet John Gould Fletcher.
So he returns to Harvard in 1905 and 6, and he wanted to room with Rogers, and he's disappointed that his friend Rogers says that he wished to be cloistered with only poetry and Nietzsche. And he must have been extremely disappointed when his real friend decides not to room with him.
He is certainly disappointed in that. Once again, Fletcher finds himself thrown outside, just as his parents withdrew from him, just as his parents kept him at a distance. Once again, this was a friend who Fletcher saw as a person with whom he could trust, and he was being kept at arm's length.
So he gets hit with a second tough blow in 1906, and that is he finds a telegram from his sister.
From the ghosts of an old house, bedroom. In this room my father died. His bed is in the corner. No one has slept in it since the morning when he wakened to meet death's hand at his heart. I cannot go to this room without feeling something big and angry waiting for me to throw me on the bed and press its thumbs into my throat.
How did his father's death affect him?
He was, in one way, shocked, certainly. This was, again, this very large presence in his life that was now removed. And Fletcher, in his own telling, self-consciously took it as a blow, but he also saw it, if you will, as a removal of a presence, of a personality, for whom Fletcher was very conscious he could not match the aspirations. In other words, his father had dreams and hopes for him, and Fletcher had no interest or ability to match those dreams and ambitions of his father.
So what's going on at school? He kind of is this ghost figure on campus.
After his father's funeral and his return to Harvard, became even less earnest in attending class, and he eventually, as we now know from a letter written by a college official to his mother, that he had left Harvard. He had resigned, mm-hmm. despite the wishes of the college officials. Nevertheless, he did not leave Harvard. He continued to shadow the college environment. And even writers such as Van Wyck Brooks, who Dungo Fletcher would later work with, remembered him as a sort of ghostly-like figure, remembers his queer white skull-like face peering out through the crimson curtains of the Harvard Union.
And you use that picture as the cover of your book, and it is such an odd picture. It's a strange skull looking out.
In part because of the way he would stare at people. He would stare intently at folks. It was not so much penetrating, it was not so much he was absorbing images or even information about people. It was just sort of a flat gaze that often unnerved people.
We're listening to biographer Ben Johnson talk about his book, Fierce Solitude, and the life of Arkansas poet John Gould Fletcher.
In both his novel, John Falconer's Fortune, written in 1919, and his collection, Life is My Song, published in 1937, John Gould Fletcher stressed a new appreciation for masculine values as a spur to his coming of age, his emerging from his female woven cocoon.
Weaker in the knees of honeybees brought you to me, sweet baby. Uh-huh. I cannot even speak. You make me think I'm going crazy. Uh-huh.
The romantic relationships that he had in his life were often problematic.
John Gould Fletcher's relations with women throughout his life were characterized by the sort of devotion, they were characterized by deference, they were characterized by falling in love quickly, and then a sense that his dependency would become a threat to his individuality and to his autonomy.
I can't stand to be alone without you. I'm dead and gone. Come on, baby, come on, knocking on my door.
At Harvard, he fell head over heels for Lois Howard, but she married, in fact, eloped with Fletcher's close friend, Lyman Willett Rogers.
What am I supposed to say? All I really want to say to you is, help me to find my way. What can I say? Drew me to your life.
Fletcher, in his relationship with friends and with lovers, often began these relationships in his own mind. His understanding, basically conjugations of how he saw these relationships unfolding. Often his imagination had little to do with reality. And so when the reality did hit him, he would find himself with a sense of betrayal that he had never had a chance.
There is a silence I carry about with me always, a silence perpetual, for it is self-created, a silence of heat, of water, of unchecked fruitfulness, through which each year the heavy harvest bloom and burst and fall.
If love was beyond his grasp, he reasoned that he must become a servant of art.
There is a silence I have achieved. I have walked beyond its threshold. I know it is without horizons, boundless, fathomless, perfect. And someday, maybe, far away, I will curl up in it at last and sleep an endless sleep.
By 1913, and like Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, Fletcher self-published. In Fletcher's case, 5 volumes, evidenced by a preoccupation with stimulating emotions through the blending of sound and color. What were his self-published volumes like?
Fletcher was part of this movement known as Imagism. It was a term that Ezra Pound had invented, and Ezra Pound was including Fletcher in this new group of poets. And the Imagist intended their work to directly appeal to the senses of the reader, and there was to be no commentary or guidance or any sort of instruction. But as often has been noted, Fletcher was not a pure imagist writer. He certainly did not want the reader to forget the poet behind the poem.
Poppies of the Red Year, A Symphony in Scarlet. The words that I have written to me become as poppies, deep angry discs of scarlet flame, full glowing in the stillness of a shut room.
And these are some heavyweight poets, T.S. Eliot, Ezra Pound, lesser so John Cornos, and Amy Lowell, who we talked about, and you said she's largely forgotten, but was quite well known at the time as a maker of other poets. She seemed to be in love with him, Amy Lowell.
Fletcher was never close to the more famous figures such as Pound and Eliot, but Amy Lowell likely seemed to have a sort of romantic aspirations toward John Gough Fletcher. She understood him to be a lost soul. She apparently was fascinated by him. But once again, John Gough Fletcher, in his view, saw her as enveloping, as trying to dictate and guide him and push him in directions that were not always in his wishes. So the relationship was both that of two poets who didn't always see eye to eye, but also as two people with, if you will, different emotional attachments toward one another.
We're listening to biographer Ben Johnson talk about his book, Fierce Solitude, and the life of Arkansas poet John Gould Fletcher. To hear part two of this program, go to artsandlettersradio.org.